Friday, everybody. Welcome to the Michael Cutler Hour. I am your host, Michael Cutler. It's been an exciting couple of past weeks, exciting to put it mildly, confusion, you name it, Washington, absolutely out of control. You can't make the stuff up that we've been witnessing. Also, today is the beginning of the Jewish New Year, so for those of my listeners out there, Happy New Year to you. But in any event, it is April the 13th, and it is Friday, and we just completed commemorating the death of 3,000 Americans this past 9/11, and incredibly, by the way, if I said April, I meant to say that it's September. Goodness gracious, the world has gone upside down, September the 13th. You know, the world has really gone upside down watching Washington and what's going on there, so we'll have lots to talk about. I've decided to fly solo this evening so we could cover a bunch of very important issues in depth, and I wanted to provide you with some of my thoughts, having just returned from a wonderful visit with the campus on the campus of Embry-Riddle University in Florida with Congressman Lou Barletta and radio talk show host Mark Bernier, a man I have tremendous respect for, both men I have tremendous respect for. In fact, I've known Mark for many years. I've been something of a regular on his radio program on radio station WNDB that is broadcast from Daytona Beach, Florida. Lou Barletta and I have known each other for quite a few years as well. I was his final witness when he was sued by the ACLU when, as mayor of Hazleton, Pennsylvania, he decided to enact immigration ordinances because he found that there were drug trafficking organizations operating in his bucolic town of Hazleton, Pennsylvania, formerly a mining town in the beautiful mountains of Pennsylvania. And the only weapon he seemed to have at his disposal was the immigration laws that the federal government refused to enforce, and this was under the Bush administration. And of course, bad as it was under Bush, it's gotten even worse under the current administration. So I thought it would be a good idea to take the time to really look at what is really going on with immigration, how it really impacts America. Those of you who are familiar with me know that I'm a retired senior special agent with what used to be the Immigration and Naturalization Service, that I spent some 30 years with that agency. We've also done a bunch of congressional hearings. I provided testimony to the 9/11 Commission, something that was very much at the forefront of my thinking all week. Again, just 2 days ago, we made note of the 12th anniversary of the terrorist attacks of 9/11. And so that's what my mission is today, as it were. If you want to call in and join the conversation, the number is 310-982-4145, 310-982-4145. And to get a little bit of business out of the way, two great websites I would very much like for you to visit. First of all, I'm a senior fellow with an organization known as CAPS, C-A-P-S, Californians for Population Stabilization. They are located in beautiful downtown Santa Barbara, California. I, of course, am on the East Coast, but love working with them. I've been writing for them for many years. I've done some speaking events for them as well, which raises another issue that if you folks out there are aware of opportunities to participate in panel discussions, debates, town hall meetings on immigration, you can reach me through michaelcutler.net, or you can go to capsweb.org. Let them know that you're trying to get hold of me, and they can also help to make that happen. But we really need to understand that the immigration laws are not about bigotry. They're not about xenophobia, all the usual tired old accusations by the open borders folks, people that I have come to refer to as the immigration anarchists. In point of fact, forgive me for my frog in my throat this evening. In point of fact, those immigration laws that we hear such disdain for legally permit more foreign workers to enter the United States each month than the number of new jobs that are being created. So if anything needs to change about immigration, it needs to be more responsive and concerned with the impact that this all has on American and lawful immigrant workers. Americans of every race, every religion, every creed, every ethnicity. That's what the immigration laws are about. It's about protecting American workers and American lives, but you would never know it to listen elected representatives. God knows who they really are representing, probably the people with the big fat checkbooks. And I want to start out by reading something to you that I think is very telling. And I think this is truly significant. Because if you look at something that was contained in the 9/11 Commission report, these are the people that looked at the attacks of 9/11 commissioned by the U.S. government. And I was watching a program about this just 2 days ago. And it was amazing that the Bush administration, pardon me, wow, this is really miserable. The Bush administration only created the 9/11 Commission after prodding and demonstrations and demands being made by the family members of the victims of the terrorist attacks. Think about it. The Space Shuttle Challenger blew up on launch. They created a commission to find out what went wrong. Space Shuttle Columbia was destroyed on reentry. A commission convened to find out what went wrong. When an airplane crashes, the NTSB, the FBI, the FAA, all kinds of people converge on the crash scene to figure out what went wrong, always with the same primary goal in mind, to make certain that every reasonable measure can be taken so that history does not get to permit itself, so that there's no more attacks, or in the case of crashes, no more loss of lives. That's the whole idea to these crash investigators. You know, you always hear them saying, we're looking for the black boxes. Well, why? Yes, part of it is about the fact that we do live in a very litigious society, so everybody wants to know who they can sue. Was it pilot error? Was it the way the plane was maintained? Was there a design flaw? What went wrong? Who can we hold accountable? But in holding accountable the people that may have contributed to a disaster, they're also doing an analysis as to how it happened so that it won't happen again. There was a plane crash, or not actually a crash, but a forced landing by an airliner several years ago. Amazing story. The plane was going through heavy rain. It was, I believe, a 737, one of the real workhorses of commercial aviation. They flew through a heavy storm, and what the rule book said, the operating instructions were, is that if you're descending and in heavy winds and so forth, idle the engines. Well, they'd never encountered so much rain going into an engine before, and it turned out that by idling the engines, the engine suffered catastrophic failures. The pilot incredibly managed to make a landing without power. Nobody injured. Unbelievable story. In fact, one engine was actually serviceable enough that they were able to replace the other engine and get the airplane to limp 15 miles to the nearest airport where they could rebuild the airplane. The pilot was incredible. Masterful job. I forgot what country the guy was from. It was a foreign air carrier. But everybody called it a miracle. Not unlike the miracle on the Hudson, if you remember that story. So here was the pilot showing tremendous skill in landing next to one of the waterways in Louisiana, as I recall the story. But the investigation determined that what caused the engines to fail was that the engines were being idled, so the water came in, the engines couldn't disperse the water, and were damaged in the process. So they turned around and said, okay, from now on, when there's lots of water, when you're flying through a heavy storm, rev up the engines, help to blow the water out of the engines, and you'll be okay. So now I assure you that every pilot who flies a 737 knows that if you go through a lot of rain, a heavy storm, crank up the engines, everything is fine, we've solved the problem, hopefully no more engine failures. That's the reason they do these investigations. Same thing with the Challenger. They said, gee whiz, it was very cold, the O-rings that were supposed to keep the gases contained in the solid rocket boosters needed to be changed because the O-rings were malfunctioning in cold weather, so they changed the O-rings. Of course, now under this administration, we don't even have a manned space program, but that's a story for another day. But again, fixes were made to address the failures that resulted in loss of life. Now let's look at 9/11. This was not the first terrorist attack inside the United States. In January of 1993, there were, in fact, two terrorist attacks. One, a guy by the name of Emil Kansi, a Pakistani national who had applied for political asylum, in January 1993, stood outside the CIA headquarters with an AK-47, opened fire upon CIA officials driving to work, parking their cars in the compound. He fled the country, which again is something that transnational criminals and gangs and international terrorists can do. They have an escape hatch. Well, this guy jumped through the hatch, not expecting we would track him down. We meaning our commandos, our guys, dragged him back here, put him on trial, found him guilty of this horrific crime where two CAA officers were wounded, three others killed. He was subsequently convicted and executed, but the people that he killed remained dead. The people that he injured remained injured. The damage was done. Just 1 month later, February 1993, first attack at the World Trade Center. Every terrorist involved in these attacks were Middle Eastern men who had gamed the visa process, gamed the immigration benefits program, including the political asylum system. And in fact, one of these knuckleheads, a guy by the name of Ramzi Youssef, the mastermind of the attack, had been granted political asylum by the government of the United States. He not only masterminded the 93 attack at the Trade Center, but the other planned attack on landmarks. Now, you would have thought that the government would have said, hey, listen, we've got to tighten up on this. And in fact, on May 20th, 1997, I testified before my very first congressional hearing on the issue of visa fraud and immigration benefit fraud. That was just about midway between the terrorist attacks of 93 and the terrorist attack of 9/11 that was yet to come. So it's just mind-boggling for me that more than 4 years after the first terrorist attacks, Congress held a hearing. When America was attacked at Pearl Harbor on December 7th, 1941, it took the United States just 44 months, less than 4 years, working with allies, some of whom were of questionable loyalty, like our so-called friends the Russians. But we built fleets of airplanes that had never existed, battleships, cruisers, aircraft carriers, submarines, PT boats. We did it. We built fleets of aircraft that had never existed, B-29 bombers and P-51 Mustangs, arguably one of the most beautiful fighter planes ever designed, the Thunderbolts, the B-17s, the B-24s, the B-25. We can go on forever. We built atom bombs, all in a span of 44 months. We built Liberty ships to keep on supplying supplies to our beleaguered allies over in Europe even before we joined the war, and then it was the Nazi Wolf Pack, the submarines, that were torpedoing our Liberty ships trying to block the flow of supplies. Absolutely amazing story. And in fact, the FBI on its website chronicles how 8 Nazi saboteurs came to America, 2 different submarines, U-boats as they were called, through Long Island and through Florida to blow up facilities in the United States to make it almost impossible, their goal, to prevent America from providing necessary supplies to the Brits, even before we got heavily involved in the war. These guys, not unlike the terrorists, entered the United States. They took a really sophisticated, circuitous route. They were brought here by U-boats. 2 of these guys, as I recall, were actually naturalized citizens, not unlike some of these terrorists that we've seen operating in the United States, who acquired lawful status or citizenship and then went on to attack us. But back then, within weeks, these guys were put on trial, found guilty. 6 were executed. 2 got lengthy jail sentences. 1, I believe, got 30 years in jail. The other got life. End of problem. The Germans, because it was such a costly operation and endangered the safety of their valuable U-boats, decided we're never going to do this again. Well, today the terrorists don't need U-boats to come to the United States, folks. All they need is an airplane ticket. They don't even need a visa if they come from 37 countries. On 9/11, there were 26 countries that were part of the visa waiver program. Today we've expanded that list to 37. War on terror. What a way to fight a war. Now, let me read to you what the 9/11 Commission report contained in part. Now, they were looking at immigration as a component of the problem, although, remarkably, you would barely know it with all the coverage we had this past week about the terrorist attacks a dozen years ago. Hard to believe, a dozen years ago. Kids that were just 10 years old back then are now adults. That's how long ago it was. This is history for so many of our fellow Americans. they weren't really old enough to appreciate what happened, and today they are old enough to vote. They need to understand the issues. Because this was a monumental failing of the U.S. government, and one that's not being corrected, but being made worse by the current administration and by the current U.S. Senate. What the House of Representatives does remains to be seen. I hope they have the integrity and the intelligence and the decency and the moral fiber to stand up to the demands for comprehensive reform. Back in 07, I wrote a commentary. Senator Jeff Sessions from Alabama quoted me from the floor of the Senate on three separate days during the floor debate. I was very proud of it. And then he's quite a gentleman. He sent me a certificate commemorating the event. My wife, in fact, framed the certificate that Senator Sessions sent me. But I called it the Terrorist Assistance and Facilitation Act. The idea of providing unknown millions of aliens whose identities, backgrounds, and intentions are unknown and unknowable with identity documents that can be used as what are known as breeder documents. You can get driver's licenses, social security cards, credit cards, library cards, which means internet access. Get a job that, if it doesn't have national security implications, may well have critical infrastructure implications. I worry about, for example, the people who process our food. I worry about people who have the ability to enter office and government office buildings, who can get on airplanes. So understand the magnitude of the problem we face, and it's a problem that's being exacerbated by the Dreamer nonsense, the so-called deferred action. The administration has provided hundreds of thousands of illegal aliens up to age 31 with identity documents without so much as a single face-to-face interview. They mail in the paperwork, they check off the right boxes, they give the right answers to the questions, they can provide a couple of slips of paper, and they get a government-issued identity document that is to be taken as seriously as the best documents that you might have in your wallet to attest as to who these people are and when they got here. We don't know who they are. We don't know what country they're even from. We certainly have no way of knowing when they came here, if they met the requirements to participate, but that doesn't matter. As we heard with Benghazi, what difference does it make, right? This seems to be the motto of our government. Hillary Clinton, when she uttered that outrageous statement about Benghazi, what difference does it make, really could have been describing the attitude of the current administration to one issue after another. We don't know who these people are. They violated our borders by coming here, but we're going to give them identity documents anyway. What difference does it make? And before you start to say, well, Cutler is being, political, I'm a lifelong registered Democrat. I don't think either political party represents the average American today. There are individuals who do. My friend Lou Barletta, who accompanied me to Florida, certainly does. Jeff Sessions and Chuck Grassley, Steve King. There are some people that truly do. I believe that Congressman Trey Gowdy is trying to do the right thing. So there are some people that you watch them, you listen to them, and you get a good sense about where their heads are at. But I got to tell you, the stakes, ladies and gentlemen, couldn't be higher. And I keep interrupting myself, and I need to stop that. So let me, without further ado, read an excerpt from the 9/11 Commission report. These were the folks, I remind you again, who spent a couple of years putting the report together to find out how the attacks could have been carried out, what the deficiencies were, how do we fix it. And here's what they said, and I'm quoting. The Immigration and Naturalization Service, INS, with its 9,000 Border Patrol agents, by the way, these statistics go back about a decade ago, so if you hear these numbers and you say, this doesn't sound right, the INS doesn't even exist. It's now been split up into different agencies. Border Patrol is part of CBP, Customs and Border Protection, and then we have ICE, and then we have Citizenship and Immigration Services, all under DHS, an agency I call the Department of Homeland Surrender. So if you hear these numbers and you say these numbers are wrong, they were accurate for the time that this report was issued nearly a decade ago. Let me go back to it. The Immigration and Naturalization Service, INS, with its 9,000 Border Patrol agents, 4,500 inspectors, and 2,000 immigration special agents, had perhaps the greatest potential the greatest potential to develop an expanded role in counterterrorism. However, the INS was focused on the formidable challenges posed by illegal entry over the southwest border, criminal aliens, and a growing backlog in applications for naturalizing immigrants. The White House, the Justice Department, and above all the Congress reinforced these concerns. In addition, when Doris Meisner became INS Commissioner in 1993, she found an agency seriously hampered by outdated technology and insufficient human resources. Border Patrol agents were still using manual typewriters. Inspectors at ports of entry were using paper watch lists. The asylum and other benefits system did not effectively deter fraudulent applications. Isn't that amazing? Right there and then, in that paragraph, they nailed it. Lack of resources, lack of technology, but I also believe it was a lack of will of people, including Doris Meisner, and I could tell you as an agent, we all had the sense that she really wasn't happy when we were arresting illegal aliens. She was very focused on creating programs to provide illegal aliens with benefits in the United States. So here the 9/11 Commission says that the asylum and other benefits systems did not effectively deter fraudulent applications. And remember, in 1997, I participated in a congressional hearing that looked at fraud in the visa program and in the benefits program. So this wasn't a new problem, but it was a problem that was never addressed by the Clinton administration, never addressed by the Bush administration, never addressed by the current Obama administration. Let me continue reading. Commissioner Meisner responded in 1993 to the World Trade Center bombing by providing seed money to the State Department's Counselor Affairs Bureau to automate the terrorist watch list used by counselor officers and border inspectors. The INS assigned an individual in a new lookout unit to work with State Department in watch listing suspected terrorists and with the intelligence community and the FBI in determining how to deal with them when they appeared at ports of entry. In 1998, 97 suspected terrorists had been denied admission at U.S. ports of entry because of the watch list. Okay, let me stop here and give you something to think about. Because the terrorists entered the United States and were inspected, 97 of them were prevented from entering. They were blocked. When people run the border, ladies and gentlemen, the watch list is irrelevant because no one inspects them. They're sneaking in. So you have people like Chuck Schumer and Harry Reid and the administration and Janet Napolitano saying, well, if they run the border, it's not a big deal. It's not a big deal. If terrorists come to understand that they can't get through a port of entry without identification, they don't just go home and throw up their hands. I mean, maybe some of them do. But how many of the more enterprising of them will say, okay, I'll go to Canada, or I'll go to Mexico, or I'll get on a boat and stow away and get into the United States by circumventing the watch lists that they spent money on drawing up? See, it's like the old spy versus spy cartoon that used to be in Mad Magazine when I was a kid. You know, we do one thing, they take another measure. We do it this way, they do it that way. It's a dynamic balancing act, and they're always looking for ways to get around whatever obstructions we throw in their path. Today, it's the administration that looks to throw obstructions in the path of those who have these immigration laws enforced. Now, understand how vital the watch list is, the inspections process is. They enhance the watch list process. But meanwhile, if people run the border, not a big deal. And Napolitano has made it clear. She said, well, it's not even a crime to run the border. Well, Janet Napolitano, I doubt you're listening to me, but if you are, here's the point. You're full of it. I'm going to be as blunt as I know how. You and I both know your nose is growing. An alien who has never been deported from the United States and enters without inspection is not committing a felony. No argument. You're sneaking in. You've never been here before. You've never been ordered deported. That's right. That's not a felony. But if you have been formally deported from the United States, an immigration judge orders you deported, you come back, at the very least, you're committing a two-year felony. Felony. 2 years in jail. Actually, a felony is any crime where the punishment is more than a year in jail. two-year felony, and that applies to people that were simply working illegally, going to school illegally, whatever. However, aliens who commit crimes and get convicted of those crimes and are deported because of those crimes take on the title of aggravated felon. I worked with the Senator Al D'Amato back when he was New York's senior senator in the early 80s to create this law. Did it behind the backs of my bosses. Got about 30, if you want to call them co-conspirators, my fellow agents to work with Al D'Amato's staff over a period of between 6 months and a year. In fact, they used to have coffee and Danish waiting for me every Wednesday night up at Al D'Amato's Midtown Manhattan office because they knew I'd be up there working with them on this. And what did we do? We changed the law. We made a clear distinction where criminal aliens entering the United States after deportation were concerned. For an alien with a criminal history, a guy who's a rapist, a drug dealer, a murderer, an arsonist, a guy who's been robbing banks, committed fraud, whatever, you've been convicted for committing felonies, you come back illegally by running the border, you are looking at a maximum of 20 years in a federal slammer just for running the border. How in the world can the woman who was in charge of the Department of Homeland Security, that's why I called the Department of Homeland Surrender, say that this isn't a felony, this isn't a crime? See, if a police officer walks by a bank and sees some guy wielding a shotgun, and he's got people on the ground, and maybe some guy has been shot, and there's blood everywhere, cop walks by and he goes, "Oops, I better call backup, there's a felony in progress." It's pretty clear that there's a felony. Border Patrol agent on the Mexican or Canadian border with his binoculars sees a group of people charging across the border, evading the inspections process. Believe it or not, that agent does not know whether or not these people are committing a felony. Because if they'd never been deported before, they're not. But if they had been deported before, they are. And lots of people who get deported do come back. And if you doubt it, just go to the ICE website, and they have the occasional story about how they arrested some criminal alien who had been previously deported and then came back and committed another crime, committed a murder, robbed a bank, was caught with guns, or whatever. So we hear this nonsense, it's not a crime to run the border. Goodness gracious, folks. Goodness gracious. How can a crime that carries with it a maximum of 20 years in jail not be considered a felony by the head of the Department of Homeland Security? This is astonishing. You know, this whole system that we're dealing with, the lies, the mistruths, the propaganda, leaves my head spinning, and I don't even want to tell you what I hear from some of the folks who are still working over at ICE. Their level of outrage is in the stratosphere. So let's make it clear. You run the border, you've been deported, you most definitely are committing a felony. And if you look at the federal laws, by the way, there are few, precious few federal crimes that carry such stringent punishment. 20 years in jail is heavy duty. 20 years in jail is not a joke. This is serious stuff. This is not the parking ticket that we were being led to believe it is. And for good reason, because when we worked with D'Amato, the goal was to send a clear message to the real bad guys. We get rid of you. You come back. Not unlike Roadrunner and Wile E. Coyote, we're going to drop a safe on your head. We don't want you back here. You know, we don't accept the garbage trucks bringing us garbage. We leave the garbage at the curb. We expect it to be disposed of. We get rid of the human garbage of the murderers and the rapists and the drug dealers. We don't want them back here. And we certainly don't want terrorists coming here. So not only is running our border a clear and present danger to national security, but it also, very often, is a serious felony. Let me continue on, though. They were even working on the idea of how to deal with deporting aliens involved in terrorism. Had no clear way of doing it, believe it or not. And here's what they said. How to conduct deportations against aliens who are suspected terrorists caused significant debate. The INS had immigration law expertise and the authority to bring the cases, but the FBI possessed the classified information sometimes needed as evidence, and information sharing conflicts resulted. New laws in 1996 authorized the use of classified evidence in removal hearings, but the INS removed only a handful of the aliens with links to terrorist activity, none identified as associated with Al-Qaeda, using classified evidence. Mid-level INS employees proposed comprehensive counterterrorism proposals to management in 1986, 1995, and 1997. I worked with some of those folks, by the way. No action was taken on them. In 1997, a national security unit was set up to handle alerts, track potential terrorist cases for possible immigration enforcement action, and work with the rest of the Justice Department. It focused on the FBI's priorities of Hezbollah and Hamas and began to examine how immigration laws could be brought to bear on terrorism. For instance, it sought unsuccessfully, to require that CIA security checks be completed before naturalization applications were approved. Think about that. This was 1997, 3 years, 4 years after the attacks of 93. And reasonably, it was a reasonable idea. They said, well, look, let's run these names through CIA databases to make certain that we aren't unwittingly giving citizenship to terrorists. And the government said, no, you won't do that. War on terror. We are strip searching 95-year-old women trying to get on airplanes. The NSA, as it turns out, is doing more than just looking at phone numbers. It seems that what they're doing is far more pervasive and more in-depth. I certainly want to be safe, and I believe the work they do is vital. But this idea that there is no longer, for all intents and purposes, a Fourth Amendment in the United States. Slowly but surely, they are out there whittling away at the Constitution, the foundation of this great republic, in the name of national security. But yet when they told the Clinton administration, we need to make certain that we aren't naturalizing terrorists, they said no. And in fact, it was the Clinton administration that implemented a program known as Citizenship USA, CUSA, where they ran over 1 million applications for U.S. citizenship through the process where half the time, I won't say half the time, but a serious percentage of the time, they did not even get back fingerprint checks on these applications, but approved the applications nonetheless. We couldn't give out citizenship fast enough under the Clinton administration. It's both sides of the aisle, folks. You know, we're seeing it from every direction. It was the Reagan administration who created the first amnesty and never hired additional agents to make sure that the employer sanctions provisions were enforced or could be enforced. Then you've got Clinton doing his thing. George Bush has Border Patrol agents prosecuted for doing their job, but sends Border Patrol agents to Iraq to secure the Iraqi border. And now here we are with the Obama administration. Both sides of the aisle. Borders are an impediment to trade. That's what the message is. Borders are an impediment to profit. Never mind the images of those young people plummeting to their deaths on 9/11 12 years ago. Never mind that. One of the family members that I used to work with over at 9/11 families said that when his son was killed, for these SOBs, this was just the cost of doing business. His son's life, and he was in his 20s at the time, his son. The cost of doing business. Let me continue. Policy questions. Again, this is the 9/11 commission that I'm reading to you. Policy questions such as whether resident alien status should be revoked upon a person's conviction of a terrorist crime were not addressed. Can you imagine that? An alien who is here essentially as the guest of the United States government could be convicted of committing a crime involving terrorism, but there was no decision made as to whether that should be enough for us to deport such an alien. What twilight zone have we entered, ladies and gentlemen? Continuing on, Congress, with the support of the Clinton administration, doubled the number of Border Patrol agents required along the border with Mexico to one agent every quarter mile by 1999. It rejected, however, efforts to bring additional resources to bear in the north. The border with Canada had one agent for every 13.25 miles, and despite examples of terrorists entering from Canada, awareness of terrorist activity in Canada and its more lenient immigration laws and an Inspector General's report recommending that the Border Patrol develop a northern border strategy, the only positive step was that the number of Border Patrol agents was not cut any further. Can you imagine this? We knew that there were terrorists entering the United States through the Canadian border, and it was a success in someone's twisted world because they didn't cut the number of agents further. One agent for every 13.25 miles? Really? And I'm not even sure that they're taking shifts into account here, by the way. Now, let's continue on. Inspectors at ports of entry were not asked to focus on terrorists. Does that not take your breath away? This was after the 93 attacks. Terrorists had entered the United States. The 93 Trade Center attack cost the lives of 6 victims. Over 1,000 were injured. Over a half billion, with a B, half billion dollars in damages inflicted on what had been the centerpiece of the New York City Lower Manhattan skyline. The tower almost came down sideways, and as Ramzi Youssef subsequently noted when he was arrested and brought back to stand trial for what he did, he said that his goal was to kill hundreds of thousands of Americans. This is the same guy that we gave safe harbor to. We gave him political asylum. And he said, well, I'm disappointed. I was hoping the building would come down sideways so we could kill a couple of hundred thousand. And you know what? Had the building come down sideways, I'm sure he would have succeeded in killing hundreds of thousands. But yet, under the Clinton administration, inspectors at the ports of entry were not asked to focus on terrorists. In fact, I can tell you personally that I know an inspector, an old friend of mine. We used to work as inspectors, as agents together, rather. He then became an inspector, and I had been an inspector at the beginning of my career. He told me that he caught holy hell from his bosses when he made referrals to the FBI about aliens that were arriving, that he had articulable evidence indicated that they might likely have an involvement with international terrorism. That's the lunacy that exists today in the United States while we talk about a war on terror. So let me repeat the sentence. Inspectors at the ports of entry were not asked to focus on terrorists. Inspectors told us they were not even aware that when they checked the names of incoming passengers against the automated watch list, that they were checking in part for terrorists. In general, border inspectors also did not have the information they needed to make fact-based determinations of admissibility. The INS initiated but failed to bring to completion 2 efforts that would have provided inspectors with information relevant to counterterrorism, a proposed system to track foreign student visa compliance, and a program to establish a way of tracking travelers' entry and exit from the United States. If you'll notice, the latest GAO reports, Government Accountability, Office of Accountability, and the Inspector General reports show that we still have no track on these people. There was just a headline that said that we lost track of 1 million non-immigrant visitors who came to the United States. So after all the money that we've spent, and we've spent over $1 billion on the Accenture company, which, by the way, used to be headquartered in Hamilton, Bermuda, it's now headquartered in Ireland, after $1 billion, they still don't know whether or not aliens leave the United States. But if you mail something by FedEx or with the Postal Service or one of the other freight forwarders, they'll tell you basically when the truck is waiting at a red light on the way to your house. The passengers leaving? No, we can't do that. And I think part of why we can't do it is because it might then cut down on the number of visa waiver countries. And that's a program that the Chamber of Commerce and the hotel and hospitality and travel industries is very keen on, because they know that the more people who they can get to come to the United States, the more profit they can make. Of course, it's short-sighted, because if you remember, after terrorist attacks of 9/11, it was seen as an act of heroism to get on board an airplane anywhere in the world and fly anywhere in the world, and they were begging people, please come to New York, come to the ball games, come to the Broadway shows, come to our restaurants, because these places were going broke. Nobody was coming to New York. Seats went begging on airplanes. But because of the greed of the moment, how many seats are filled on the airplane today? How many hotel rooms are occupied today? How many seats in the ballpark are filled today? Nobody seems to understand that tomorrow we could wake up to a nightmare. On April 14th, the runners of the Boston Marathon could not have imagined that the next day some of them would be missing body parts, that some of their friends would be killed, that some of them would suffer severe head injuries, because they didn't know that in less than 24 hours, international terrorists would set off bombs that would do such destruction to hundreds of runners and others. See, the terrorists that are out there working in their little garages or the little holes that they're operating in, they've got their plans. And I'm not trying to, you know, be talking about scaring people. Oh, the boogeyman's hiding under your bed at night. But folks, we are talking about terrorists who are determined to kill us. Last 9/11, we had the attack at Benghazi. On April 15th, which is perhaps why I started out talking about April today, because I'm still fixated what happened on the 15th this year of April, we had the terrorist attack by aliens who I would argue at least their files should be looked at by ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, because the Tsarnaev family, according to published reports, got political asylum. Now, I'm a big fan of political asylum. Back in college, I was a B'nai B'rith president, and I went to demonstrations in Washington to try to get President Johnson to get the Russians to cooperate and let religious minorities such as Jews and others leave Russia and go to any country that would have them, including the United States. It was a privilege for me as an immigration inspector sitting in a booth at Kennedy Airport to admit refugees into the United States. I can't tell you how heartwarming it was to admit a family into the country, to be the guy that signed off on their paperwork, to see this young couple with their two or three kids all excited. In some cases, they had tears streaming down their faces because this was a lifelong dream to come to America. And it was exciting to be part of that. Those were the days I absolutely adored my job. And now we're finding out that political asylum, because of the ineptitude and incompetence of our government, nonfeasance, misfeasance, and malfeasance, this has now become a method of entry for those who would kill us and have killed our people. So understand just how screwy this is. So all these laws and all these mechanisms that should be protecting us aren't protecting us because of a political equation. This is wherein lies the problem. And finally, this excerpt says, in 1996, a new law enabled the INS to enter into agreements with state and local law enforcement agencies through which the INS provided training and the local agencies exercised immigration enforcement authority. This is the so-called 287G program, folks. Terrorist watch lists were not available to them. Well, that's great. Mayors in cities with large immigrant populations sometimes impose limits on city employee cooperation with federal immigration agents. A large population lives outside the legal framework. These are the sanctuary cities, folks. New York, one of them, and New York got hammered the worst on 9/11. And here's what the 9/11 Commission says. A large population lives outside the legal framework. Fraudulent documents could easily be obtained. Congress kept the number of INS agents static in the face of the overwhelming problem. And now we have people like Chuck Schumer saying, well, doing nothing isn't acceptable. Well, that's not necessarily so, Chuck. Because if you're listening, and I doubt it, the reality is that if you were in a car that's going down a hill with failed brakes, stepping on the gas is doing something, and it's exactly the wrong something to do. Giving identity documents to people when you're not confirming their identity opens the door to terrorists. And look at what they said. Fraudulent documents could be easily obtained. So here, these documents aren't fraudulent, but they're being fraudulently obtained because the claims being made by the applicants are fraudulent, but we don't have the resources, the wherewithal, or the desire as a country to make certain that the guy who claims to be Muhammad, who claims to be Miguel so-and-so, isn't Muhammad so-and-so, because we know that every week our good friends in Iran have flights going directly from Tehran to Caracas, Venezuela. We know there are terror training camps in the tri-border region of Brazil. Mike McCall, who heads Homeland Security in Congress, had a report written about the issue on the southwest border, calling it a line in the sand. Peter King, when he chaired Homeland Security in the House, talked about how there were Iranian shock troops embedded in the United States. The shock troops, the Quds, were behind, if you remember, an attempt to kill the Saudi ambassador several months before the last presidential election. They were going to blow up the embassy, the Saudi embassy, and possibly the Israeli embassy as well. So we have Chuck Schumer saying, hey, we have to give these people identity documents. We're to get them out of the shadows. Well, here's a question that no one asks. Maybe you want to think about asking this of your elected representative. Terrorists who know that their fingerprints won't trigger any alarms certainly will be emboldened to come forward, get identity documents and lawful status under fake names. We won't be able to detect that. Aliens involved with terrorism who know that their fingerprints will set off those alarms will not come forward. So here's my question. There's probably a million criminal aliens out there whose fingerprints would set off all the alarm bells. How many of those million do you think are going to show up and say, here I am, unless they're able to game the system and maybe use somebody else's fingerprints to make it appear that they're somebody who they aren't? Short of that, they're not coming forward. They're going to remain in the shadows. The most dangerous threats to public safety and national security are not going to come forward. So who's going to go look for them? They're playing a game of hide and seek. They're hiding. We're not seeking. And there is nothing in comprehensive reform that would provide resources or a mandate that anyone should look for those who don't come forward. So how does that make us safer? The terrorists who know that their fingerprints will come up as no record will come forward, get identity documents and brand new names. They'll be out there. Basically, I call that the masquerade ball. And terrorists who know that their biometrics will trigger alarms will simply continue hiding in the shadows, and we don't have the wherewithal, the resources, the inclination, or the mandate to look for the ones that remain in the shadows. So what is the point to the exercise? How does this benefit America and Americans? So we're talking about the national security implications of 9/11. And by the way, if you want to call and join the conversation, my number is 310-982-4145. And we're taking a look back at 9/11 and the stuff that wasn't discussed in the mainstream media this past week, much to my disappointment and frustration. There's a story now, really amazing, how two brothers, both naturalized citizens from the Philippines, entered into a conspiracy to send military-grade weapons to the Philippines. There's no immediate information that they were involved with terrorists, but their brother, back in the Philippines, was selling these firearms to people that would provide the money. And we're talking about heavy-duty guns, weapons, all kinds of stuff. Now, in this case, we're talking about a New York City police officer who's a naturalized citizen, Rex Gene Marillit. His brother, Wilfredo Marillit, works for CBP, Customs and Border Protection, in Los Angeles, I believe at LAX, Los Angeles International Airport. They're charged with conspiracy to violate the Arms Exportation Control Act and with conspiracy to engage in unlicensed firearm dealing. These guys are naturalized. Now, I don't know. Maybe they became naturalized citizens when they were very, very young. There's nothing in any of the accounts, either on the ICE website or in the news reports, as to when they immigrated to the United States. But understand how valuable citizenship is. And there are parts of the 9/11 Commission report that talk about how it was vital for the terrorists of 9/11 and other terrorists to get co-conspirators who could easily travel around the world. And they specifically talk about aliens who participate in the visa waiver program. So here we have two guys who get into law enforcement, they're naturalized citizens, and what do? They become gun runners, sending firearms back to the Philippines. They were arrested. They've been charged with the crime. Of course, this is only an indictment. Maybe they really didn't do it. Maybe this is, you know, whatever. You're innocent until proven guilty, so I have to make that point. But if they are guilty of the crimes for which they are charged, it is yet another example of how naturalized citizens made use of their lawful status and citizenship in order to operate criminally inside the United States. U.S. citizenship is the key to the kingdom. It's the platinum key. A green card is the gold key. Citizenship is the platinum key. And we're giving it out with great abandon, with no integrity to the process. This is crazy stuff, folks. And we're being told that the same system that can't deal with the issue today with even a modicum of integrity is somehow going to be able to deal with the onslaught of who knows? They're claiming 11 million. I'm willing to bet it'll be 30 or 40 million applications. They're just going to take out the approval stamp and run it at warp speed. And remember, it only takes minutes to approve an application, but hours or days to deny one. So if your boss comes to you and says, boy, I want you to look for fraud. Oh, but by the way, you need to process whatever the number is. They're going to give them a quota, 20 applications per day, whatever. That boss has covered his backside because he could turn around and say, look, I warned my workers, my adjudicators, you got to look for fraud. Yeah, well, I told them they had to do 20 a day, but make fraud the priority. Well, you can't do both. This is Lucy at the Bon Bon Factory, and we are all smart enough to know that there is an inverse relationship between quality and quantity. The quicker you work, the less accurately you work. So understand that we're not just talking about giving people library cards or a card for food stamps, and you say, oh, it's costing us a couple of bucks. We are talking about a program that will enable foreign nationals to acquire identity documents, potentially in false names, the same tactic used by terrorists, the same tactic used by criminals. When we think about people getting arrested, a couple of images quickly come to mind. You know, when the police come, they put the handcuffs on. So the first image about an arrest is what? Handcuffs. The second issue, the mugshot, which is a way of identifying the person, isn't it? And then we always think about the fingerprinting. We always think about the fingerprinting because it's expected that bad guys lie about who they are. I used to jokingly say that you can always tell a good guy from a bad guy. The good guy gets up in the morning, he stretches and yawns and takes care of his biological needs, if you get my drift, and then he goes through his stuff to figure out what he wants to wear. A bad guy gets up, does the same rituals, and then goes through his stuff to figure out who he wants to be. So here we have a system in place that has no ability to verify the identities of millions of people who we know may well contain, undoubtedly contains criminals and terrorists among them, who want nothing more than to get an official identity document in a false name. Crazy stuff. You can't make it up. And then we have another story that was just published on the ICE website, September 6th, last week, 2013. HSI, by the way, HSI, Homeland Security Investigations, it's remarkable that these are ICE agents, but they needed to get the word immigration out of ICE, so they've given them new badges, new raid jackets, new everything. They call them HSI. They arrested three Pakistanis, two of whom are naturalized citizens, okay? And one was a visitor from Pakistan, and they were engaged in selling counterfeit merchandise, and they were sending the money back to Pakistan. Now, maybe they were just enriching their own bank books, but we also know that terrorists commit crime in order to put the money into their coffers so that they have the funds to carry out terrorist attacks. When you have people from that part of the world committing crimes and getting involved with serious amounts of money, you really have to wonder what the ultimate purpose for the money was. So that's another item for everyone to think about. Now, you know, we know that right now there's a group called Forward.us, I believe it is, FWD. It's really a front for Bill Gates and Zuckerberg and all those other mega wealthy entrepreneurs saying we need comprehensive reform immediately. They're telling our leaders in Washington, this is remarkable, that if we don't have foreign entrepreneurs coming to America, that America can't be successful. What nobody seems to notice is that these individuals themselves are naturalized Americans, are not naturalized, they were native-born American citizens. They didn't come here from somewhere else. So think of the chutzpah of individuals who were actually born in the United States, who were successful entrepreneurs, perpetrating the lie that if we don't bring in foreign entrepreneurs, we're screwed. Well, you know, let's look at Elon Musk, and I think he's a good example. He was born in South Africa, immigrated legally to Canada, and then came to America legally, got his green card. Elon Musk was the founder of PayPal, founder of the Tesla electric car company, and now he's also the guy that founded SpaceX. Brilliant, brilliant guy, incredible success story, makes gazillions of dollars, one of the wealthiest men in the world, but the system permitted him to come here. You know, if he was blocked from coming here, then I could understand why people are arguing. This guy was given a green card. I don't know if he's naturalized or not, but certainly he was legally immigrated to the United States with the blessings of our government. So why do we need to change any of this? Now, you're going to hear an argument from these folks, the open borders crowd, the pro-amnesty. And this is all about cheap labor. You know, I'm writing a piece right now for Accuracy in Media, AIM. And one of the points that I made is that those of you old enough to remember, Willie Sutton was the infamous bank robber who spent 40 years robbing banks. He stole over $2 million as a bank robber. And back then, it was an amazing amount of money. And they asked him once, well, why do you go to the banks? And without missing a beat, Willie Sutton said, well, that's where the money is. Well, why does Bill Gates go to India and other third world countries for programmers? Because that's where the cheap labor is. And nobody notices that these guys are American citizens, right? But one of the arguments they will tell you is that once we give foreign students the education, the training, it's silly to send them back to their country because then America doesn't get the benefit of their education, their training, and their skills. So we have to now allow them to stay forever. Even while we have how many American programmers, engineers, and scientists looking for jobs? See, I have a different solution. We should not be educating foreign students at a time, especially when so many American kids live in poverty. There was a recent Reuters news report, very disturbing, that said that children who live in poverty because of the stress that poverty imposes, this battle for survival on a daily basis so wears them down, that it creates the equivalent of a 13-point drop in IQ. I didn't say it. A study published by Reuters news agency did. So here is the solution to being concerned about foreign students not staying in America to help grow American industry. And by the way, you'd be hard-pressed to find a really American company because most of them send factories overseas, import foreign workers. They're American when putting a flag or a logo like a flag on their product helps sales. These are multinational corporations. But in any event, if your concern is that by not allowing foreign students to stay in the country, we hurt American industry, I have an easier solution. Stop training foreign students. Start training American kids. How many American children living in poverty would do anything for a shot at universities? There are some colleges that, as I've been told, are offering all-expense-paid scholarships to illegal alien children. If that doesn't boil your blood, check for a flatline EEG. You want to break the cycle of poverty and violence? Because children who live in abject squalor, where they hear gunfire every night and where rats run through their buildings every day and roaches to be found scurrying along the walls and in their clothing, they will do anything to get out. And when they don't have a legitimate outlet for their desires, folks, they become involved in criminal activity. You want to break that chain? You want to break that cycle? Get those kids those scholarships that the universities can't wait to give to aliens who have no right to be here. When in the world did it become anti-immigrant to be pro-American? Because lots of American citizens are, in fact, themselves immigrants who came here legally, went through the process, got a green card, and ultimately applied for United States citizenship. Cute little story. I was over on Neil Cavuto's show a couple weeks ago, and the driver said to me, he said, you know, Mr. Cutler, he said, I came from India, but I'm now an American citizen. My children were born here. But it frustrates me when I call my bank and I wind up calling back home to India where I used to live. This is the lunacy of these international or multinational corporations. So instead of looking at what's really going on and saying, well, how do we address these issues? We're being sold a fantasy, an absolute fantasy, that we have to allow foreign students to get green cards. We should staple green cards onto their diplomas. We've heard this from candidates from both political parties, and it's nuts. And it's absolutely nuts. I just find this to be mind-boggling. I want to read something. We're running close to the bottom of the program, the end of the program. We're going to go a little bit long today, as I very often do. I want to quote a couple things from the 9/11 Commission staff report. I think it's really important. And I think it's important for you to go to the WNDB website, go to C-SPAN, and look up the terrific program that Mark Bernier of radio station WNDB put together. He's a great host, and he was a great moderator. It was a privilege to be on the air with my friend Lou Barletta, congressman from Pennsylvania. But, you know, just look at the lunacy to what we're hearing. Here is a quote from the 9/11 Commission staff report on terrorist travel. It is perhaps obvious to state that terrorists cannot plan and carry out attacks in the United States if they are unable to enter the country. Yet prior to September 11, while there were efforts to enhance border security, no agency of the U.S. government thought of border security as a tool in the counterterrorism arsenal. Indeed, even after 19 hijackers demonstrated the relative ease of obtaining a U.S. visa and gaining admission into the United States, border security still is not considered a cornerstone of national security policy. We believe, for reasons that we will discuss in the following pages, that it must be made one. This was the first paragraph taken directly from the preface of the 9/11 Commission report, and it was kind of funny because it echoed some of my own testimony when I testified before congressional hearings on this very same issue. There are two other quotes, and these are really important, also to be found in the 9/11 Commission staff report on terrorist travel. This paragraph comes on, or is found on page 47. Once terrorists had entered the United States, their next challenge was to find a way to remain here. Their primary method was immigration fraud. For example, Yusuf and Ajaj concocted bogus political asylum stories when they arrived in the United States. Mahmoud Abu Alima, involved in both the World Trade Center and landmark plots, received temporary residence under the Seasonal Agricultural Worker Program, or SAW, which, by the way, one of the chief architects was Chuck Schumer. They didn't say that. I'm telling you that. That's my footnote. After he falsely claimed that he picked beans in Florida. Now, here is the final paragraph that I want to read to you, again, from the 9/11 Commission staff report on terrorist travel, and it is found on page 98. Terrorists in the 1990s, as well as the September 11th hijackers, needed to find a way to stay in or embed themselves in the United States if their operational plans were to come to fruition. As already discussed, this could be accomplished legally by marrying an American citizen, achieving temporary worker status, or applying for asylum after entering. In many cases, the act of filing for an immigration benefit sufficed to permit the alien to remain in the country until the petition was adjudicated. Terrorists were free to conduct surveillance, coordinate operations, obtain and receive funding, go to school and learn English, make contacts in the United States, acquire necessary materials, and execute an attack. Think of how outrageous that is. Think of the lunacy when you read that and you realize that the reason that we had the 9/11 Commission convened in the first place was to make certain that this didn't happen again. And yet, if you look at what Alan Greenspan had to say, Greenspan was all about lowering the wages. In fact, let me pull up for you one more quick quote. And this again blows my mind, because this is Alan Greenspan, the architect, arguably, according to Fox News, one of the key architects of the meltdown of the economy. And so he makes this statement where he talks about, let me read this. This is the reason why we need to open up immigration quotas for highly skilled workers, you know, computer programmers, scientists, technicians, biologists, and so forth. First, skilled workers and their families form new households. They will, of necessity, move into vacant housing units, the current glut of which is depressing prices of American homes. And, of course, house price declines are a major factor in mortgage foreclosures and the plunge in value of the vast quantity of U.S. mortgage-backed securities that has contributed substantially to the disabling of our banking system. Now, this statement was made April 30th, 2009, just about when the bottom was falling out. Okay? The second bonus of providing unlimited visas, or many, many more temporary work visas for high-tech workers, that's the bonus that he's talking about. The second bonus would address the increasing concentration of income in this country. Greatly expanding our quotas for the highly skilled would lower wage premiums of skilled, over the lesser skilled. Skill shortages in America exist because we are shielding our skilled labor force from world competition. Quotas have been substituted for the wage pricing mechanism. In the process, we have created a privileged elite. Privileged elite, folks, think about that, whose incomes are being supported at non-competitively high levels by immigration quotas on skilled professionals. Eliminating such restrictions would reduce at least some of our income inequality. Income inequality, skilled over lesser skilled, what he's really providing is a way of destroying the middle class. When you can refer to middle class workers as the privileged elite, it blows my mind. Mayor Bloomberg just a couple of weeks ago said, in addition to stop and frisk, which has gotten a negative ruling out of the courts, I understand why we have stop and frisk, but I also understand concerns about Fourth Amendment. But Bloomberg is torque. We got to fingerprint people that live in public housing. And he actually said, he was quoted in the news as saying that people who live in public housing can't have trespassers wandering around. They want the police. They want someone to stop people in their buildings and say, who are you? Why are you here? And I made this point in Florida when I was with Lou Barletta. Those are essentially the questions that the immigration inspector at a port of entry asked, the CBP inspector. Who are you? Why are you here? So if you trespass in public housing, Bloomberg wants you arrested, wants you prosecuted. Wants people around there asking anybody seen wandering around, who are you? Why are you here? Stop people on the street if they look suspicious. We've got to be careful because of crime, right? Take away the guns, get the stop and frisk, fingerprint people in the. I mean, forget about Fourth Amendment privacy, First Amendment, Second Amendment. Bloomberg is all about safety and security. New York is a sanctuary city. So if you trespass in public housing, he wants you in jail. If you trespass on America for reasons only known to you, he wants to give you a key to the city. The disconnect is beyond anything you could imagine. We are admitting nearly 100,000 lawful immigrants every month, ladies and gentlemen. These are folks who are on the pathway to citizenship. We're told there's no legal way for people to come here and become citizens. We naturalize over 600,000 citizens every year. That's more than the rest of the world combined. We admit more than 1 million lawful immigrants. Again, more than the rest of the world combined. So even though some of the people being admitted as immigrants are children, they will, God willing, grow up and reach the labor age. So the kid that came in 10 years ago at age 10 is now 20 and looking for a job. We are admitting over 400,000 foreign students every year. They will almost always qualify for what is known as practical training, which means a job. We are admitting H-1B and H-2A work visas. We are admitting other people under other categories of visas, all entitled to work in the United States. Realize that we are admitting more foreign workers to the visitor exchange program. That's another doozy, by the way, where you have kids mostly from Europe, by the way, getting jobs in day camps, sleepaway camps, driving ice cream trucks, doing jobs that American college kids would love to have. In fact, I did a story about that on Neil Cavuto a year or two ago about these foreign exchange visitors. Getting the cream jobs that American kids would love to have, State Department steps in and says, oh, no, that's not for Americans. These are for foreign exchange visitor kids. So we are admitting more foreign workers who are legally entitled to work in America every month than the number of new jobs that are being created. And I have to tell you, I was listening to Bill O'Reilly, and I've been with O'Reilly on his program a couple of times. He's very opinionated. We all know that. Bill's got a strong opinion. And we heard Geraldo Rivera, and I've met Geraldo, and yeah, he's got his strong opinions. And they were talking about lazy Americans who are happy to be on the dole, happy to go on unemployment, happy to go on welfare, happy to go on disability, because they're lazy and they just don't want to work. And yeah, there may well be some lazy people that have no self-respect and are lazy and they aim low, they don't aim high. But we are at a 35-year high for worker non-participation in the labor movement, in the labor market today in the United States. That number keeps growing. These are people who a year ago, 2 years ago, 3 years ago had a job. They're not happy to be home. The job was taken out from under them. I remember John F. Kennedy was known for his wit. There was even a book about the Kennedy wit. And a kid once asked Kennedy, a young man at a news conference, said, "Mr. President, how did you become a war hero?" And typical JFK, he said, "It was purely involuntary. They sank my boat." And, of course, everybody laughed. Well, for those workers who lost their jobs, their place in society is there, not because of any fault of their own. Their careers were sunk by greedy corporations and the economic crisis that in part was created by the meltdown of the economy, which in large measure was created by providing subprime mortgages to people who couldn't afford them, including illegal aliens, where they couldn't even do a reasonable background check or credit check on people whose identities were unknown and unknowable. So this vilification of American workers and saying, oh, they don't work because they don't want to, it boils my blood. When they say they created 165 or 170 or 130,000 jobs, and then 3 weeks later they say, oop, we made a mistake, there were really fewer jobs, they almost always have to lower the number. I don't know how that happens. It's strange, isn't it? But what nobody asks is how many of those jobs are part-time jobs? How many of those jobs are seasonal jobs? So they're only good for 3 months or whatever. And how many of those jobs are minimum wage jobs? So you have more foreign workers chasing fewer jobs, and we have a vicious cycle. So you have Americans who, rather than contributing to the economy, are draining the economy because, yeah, they are now taking advantage of certain safety net programs, because if they don't, they won't be able to live. This is how they're getting their food. This is how they're keeping their families together. It's not a good situation, and I'm willing to bet that there's a lot of these folks who, if you called them up tomorrow morning and said, "Hey, Charlie, hey, Barbara, I got a job for you, and it pays a decent wage," they wouldn't be able to get dressed and head for that job fast enough. The journalists that are quick to criticize American workers are doing everybody a disservice. It's easy to pontificate about how lazy Americans sit home and don't work. If you don't know how someone wound up unemployed, then you shouldn't be quick to jump to conclusions. It's disgusting, and to me it's not much different from blaming the rape victim for being too pretty. You know, the bottom line is I believe that there are many hardworking Americans who are disgusted with themselves and the situation that they find themselves in through no fault of their own. Our government is failing to meet the most fundamental requirements for its own citizens, and that's looking after the safety and well-being of America and Americans. It's about national security. It's about decent jobs for American workers. And as long as we are so hell-bent on bringing in foreign students and providing them with opportunities we don't provide to our own kids, the equation won't get better. It will get worse. You know, we've often seen those pictures, the harrowing pictures of a parent that races into a burning building to save their own child before they try to save someone else's kid. No one ever criticizes the parent for saving their own first. When has it become anti-immigrant to be pro-American? What in the world is going on where our country thinks it's somehow more important, and the news media thinks it's more important to report on the plight of illegal aliens than on the plight of American families? This is nuts. And these allegations of racism are despicable. It's America's minorities, blacks, Latinos, and others, who are suffering the highest poverty and unemployment rates right now. This isn't about racism, folks. This is about common sense, which unfortunately has been lacking from the debate, lacking from the discussion. My mission ever since 9/11 has been to provide my perspectives based not on some fantasies, but based on reality, so that the information that you're not getting in the mainstream media will be provided to you here on the Michael Cutler Hour. And that's why I do this program, because I am determined to make certain that we can show the politicians that we're not as dumb as they had hoped that we are. You know, I always like to end commentaries by reminding everybody that democracy is not a spectator sport. In the coming weeks, we're going to hear a lot about Syria, although that seems to be winding down now that President Obama has it would seem, found a father figure in Mr. Putin. Boy, what a father figure that is. I don't know how else to account for the weirdness going on in that part of the world, and it's certainly disconcerting, to say the least. But sooner or later, the debate about immigration is going to rear its ugly head again. And I want you to head them off at the pass. I want you to start making phone calls on Monday morning to your elected members of Congress. Make it clear to them that this is a betrayal of America and Americans. The idea of providing illegal aliens with benefits and opportunities that we are unable or unwilling to provide to our own citizens and our own children. Charity most definitely begins at home. Please make it a point of passing the information along to your friends and neighbors. Ask them to get involved. I'm trying to create a bucket brigade of truth. Look forward to joining you again next week at the same time right here on the Michael Cutler Hour. Meanwhile, please go to my two favorite websites, the Michael Cutler Hour. Please go to capsweb.org. You can reach me through either organizations. If you become aware of opportunities for panel discussions and the like on college campuses, check out the C-SPAN video of this event that we just did, the student forum at Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University. Pass that along, and hopefully the road show can come to a town near you soon. But we really need to arm ourselves with the facts that are unfortunately all too rare in this wacky era. That's all for now, folks. Have a great weekend. See you next week.